Good afternoon and welcome to Time Out, your program of informative interviews with persons of note, persons with fascinating careers, leaders of today and tomorrow, and others who will allow you to invest an hour and receive a guaranteed valuable return. So stay tuned. This is Bill Hendrickson, your host of Time Out in a cloudy day in Carrboro, North Carolina, with heavy storms predicted. So we'll hurry through this show so we can both get home before the heavy storms are predicted. You know, we're so lucky at this little radio station to have people around the area that are so knowledgeable and have had, as I say, interesting careers, leaders of today and tomorrow. And in one case, we have a man today who's been he's a leader today and tomorrow. And you were a leader yesterday. Well, how many years were you a leader in the Foreign Service, Mike Cotter?
Well, I was in the Foreign Service.
How many years were you in it?
32 years.
Wow. Yeah. And I noticed you started out at Stanford, and you specialized in Latin American studies. What tuned you in toward Latin American studies?
Actually, by the time I went to Stanford, I had had a tour in Bolivia already.
With whom?
With the State Department. The State Department sent me to Stanford.
Oh.
They have a university training
program.
Well,
no, but you were in Stanford as an undergraduate.
No, I was a Georgetown undergraduate.
Oh, okay. I'm looking at your list here. Georgetown, and then Stanford was later.
Stanford was later.
I see. Okay.
And so.
And Michigan was in the middle, and law school.
Correct.
Yeah. So they sent you to Stanford for Latin American studies.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right. So do you speak Spanish?
I do. Okay. I still speak
Can you get
pretty
it?
Fluent Spanish.
Okay, good. You can get in conversation. That's good. Well, don't try it on me because I do not speak. I hardly speak any German, even though I was in the military in Germany, and they sent me to German language school. But like a two-week language school doesn't do much for you.
No, it doesn't. I mean, I studied Spanish in Spain for a year, and I've been to Spanish assignments a lot. It got to the point where I was pretty fluent.
Well, we were talking before the show started, of course, about today's big event, and I said to him, I said, probably when we finish the conversation and get home, the summit will be over and they've made decisions, and Mike Cotter didn't think that was quite right.
Well, they may have made some kind of decisions, but it won't probably be an end of the story. I mean, there's no way the two of them will agree on everything that has to happen. So my guess is they will each come out of the meeting and report back to their people and tell them what next steps there are.
Well, okay, so we have only, from what I am, two presidents, or whatever you call him, and this president, and two interpreters. That's four people in the room. That's what I've been.
Right.
So after that, after they finish their conversation, which is supposed to last for 2 hours, I guess.
I think that's about right, yeah.
Interpreters and have to get the information that they. I'm sure it's been recorded while it's being said too.
Well, that's a good question. You know, nothing has been said about that, and it's difficult to tell. I mean, the positive thing is that at least President Trump will have an interpreter. I mean, on some of his early telephone calls with Putin, he was on the phone, and the only interpreter for the conversation was Putin's interpreter.
Yeah, that's right.
And some other of his conversations, which means, of course, that you're getting a slant on it that comes from the other side. So
right.
At least he will have an interpreter. I don't know who it is. It may be our ambassador to Singapore, who I think speaks Korean.
Have you ever been in a meeting where there's two interpreters? Both sides, both languages, or whatever you want to call it.
I've been an interpreter in some of those things.
Have you?
Yeah. I've been in ones where I was in one in Turkey where with military officers where the interpreter was the Turkish general's interpreter. And in the end of it, I concluded that he had not interpreted things the same way I would have.
Well, how do you settle that?
Well, you don't. I mean, the meeting's over, and then I wrote up a report pointing out the things that I thought hadn't been interpreted correctly.
Interesting. So the interpreters can disagree, obviously, which I suppose they naturally would, because inflections and so forth would cause some misunderstandings, maybe innocently.
Yeah, it's particular. It's nuance that comes.
Yeah,
the problem
right.
with this simultaneous interpretation, which they're not really doing simultaneous means is I'm talking English. There's someone in a booth who literally, as I go on, is translating. What generally happens in these cases, two things. Number one, you want your principal to speak in short paragraphs.
Okay, yeah.
Because you're probably taking some kind of shorthand or some kind of short notes, and then your principal says a couple of things, and you translate it. And then you wait for the thing coming back, which will be translated by the other guy's interpreter. And you may, if you're interpreting, sit and listen to that, and you may take some notes.
You mean the speaker, the principal, or are you talking about the interpreter taking notes?
Yeah, we're going to get complicated here. So the interpreter, the principal is hopefully the principal's taking notes of what the other guy's interpreter is saying.
Okay, so
and you're the
principal. So Trump is, you say, should be taking notes
when Kim Jong Un is talking.
Yeah,
and his interpreter is in. Trump should be taking notes about what he's saying. Trump's interpreter will probably should also be taking notes about what he's saying.
Uh-huh.
Then Trump speaks. While Trump is speaking, his interpreter takes a couple of notes just to know what's going on. So if Trump talks, let's say, for 10 minutes, it's very hard for the interpreter, without taking some kind of notes, to know what's said.
I see.
So again, the success of this depends upon the principal understanding the interpretation process. So a good principal will talk in short paragraphs and give his interpreter a chance to say to interpret what he just said.
So what you're telling me should have been instructed to the two principals.
Well, my experience with this is principals do things the way they do them, and whoever's doing the interpreting has to figure out how to deal with it. Interpreters don't generally tell their principal, no, you need to speak in short things so I can cover it. So, no.
Well, I mean, but I would think even Trump, who likes to be the head man on the street, would want his words to be properly translated,
right.
and he would want the other guy's word properly translated to him.
Right. He would. The problem with that is it breaks up a conversation because you're not talking freely about what you want to say. You're talking, trying to keep in mind what your interpreter is going to have to do to translate that. So it's an awkward situation. People who do this on a regular basis understand how it gets done. Trump hasn't done much of it, I don't think. So,
well, he talked to other foreign leaders, but they all speak English, French and German.
Yes, they almost all do. Sometimes they don't like to, but
I know, yeah, right? Yeah,
but they tend to. So it'll be interesting to see. After that, I presume Trump would come out and talk to his delegation and say, "Here's what we decided, and here are next steps." Unless, on the other hand, he looks into Kim Jong-un's eyes and doesn't see his soul, and the thing breaks up, in which case it won't last 2 hours. It'll be shorter than that. But let's assume the best is that they can come to some kind of an agreement. So each of them will come out and go back to their staffs and say, okay, here's what we decided. Here are the next steps. Now, we're going home, and so I've told my people and you've told your people that you'll be here for the next week putting flesh on this. Or you'll say, we need time to think about this, so we're going to go home and we'll be in touch. I mean, there are a whole variety of ways this can work.
So when this conversation is going on and the interpreters are sitting there beside them, wouldn't this also be sent out to like the Secretary of State of each country so they can listen elsewhere?
Not if it's the two principals alone. I mean, this always worries the other professionals because they never know what their bosses are going to say. Trump is not the first president who has had one-on-ones without anyone there or with just an interpreter.
Who did this otherwise?
Well, I was in a meeting Clinton had with the president of Turkmenistan, and after lunch, the two of them took a walk in the Rose Garden with the interpreter.
And you were not the interpreter?
No.
Oh, okay.
We never did find out exactly what they talked about.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, well, one of the goals was to
You were the ambassador there.
It was the two of them and an interpreter.
I know, but eventually you knew, didn't you?
Well, you got some kind of an answer from Clinton about what he talked about. Everybody, we had wanted him to talk about human rights, and I know he didn't talk about it. Oh, that didn't come up, he says.
Well, oh, really?
Sure. Whereas if,
what was he doing there in the first place?
Well, he came on an official visit.
Uh-huh.
A lot of these people come. That was an official visit that was put together by outside interests who were hoping to do investments. It was not something recommended by the embassy or the State Department.
Okay, so he was there not really as a result of your request or your staff.
Right, we recommended against it.
Oh, did you?
And so did the State Department.
Wow.
I mean, so the way Trump does
business.
So presidents
do these things any way they want to, I guess.
Presidents do all sorts of things, yeah. And respond to all sorts of strange impulses. Trump may be a bit more so, but in many – well, he's different in a whole lot of ways, but there are ways where other presidents have done things too. So, you know, we'll have to see what comes out of the meeting and whether – the delegations then continue working right away, whether our delegation comes back and mulls this over, whether they then decide that this isn't going anywhere. I assume if it's not going anywhere, Trump would make that known right away.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not the kind of guy who would sit and mull this over and then say. He will talk to Kim and try to get a sense of whether he's being, you know, dealt with honestly or not, and go away from there. And since he's not a master of detail, I don't know whether his people have given him and said, well, you know, at the very least, Mr. President, you need to get him to make a firm commitment to denuclearizing at some point. And you don't want to make verbal commitments to him that we will do something first. I mean, there's a whole series.
Well, yeah, that sequence is so important.
It is. And of course, we have no idea, and we wouldn't under any other president as well, any idea of how this had been worked out, except in most cases, it's been worked out by staffs in advance, and a lot of that leaks. So by the time the two heads of state meet, everybody pretty much knows what's going to come out of the meeting, unless it's a disaster.
Well, there was some preliminary meeting, though, weren't there? Pompeo met with somebody from North Korea?
Yes, there have been a couple of meetings, but it's never been clear exactly what, if any, things. Again, well, it was Pompeo who's been in these things, and right. They have managed to keep quite close held. I haven't heard or read about serious leaks about what was agreed upon between Pompeo and his counterparts to set this meeting up.
So would it be natural, however, for the preliminary meetings, like the Pompeo meetings, to inform the other guys from North Korea what might be on Trump's agenda?
Certainly what we would expect.
Yeah.
And they would say what they expect, how much they would have danced around the issue of, well, yes, we expect this and you expect that, and who's going to make the first step? I don't have any idea. Those are the kinds of things that, again, in preliminary discussions, you would have worked out what each side has to do.
Yeah.
And then you'd probably leave it to the two heads of state to come to agreement on how it actually works. In this case, you're likely to get the two heads of state to agree on where things go from there, and then leaving it up to delegations to put flesh on that.
Do you think this whole thing is a good idea?
Well, I think it's a good idea if we can come to agreement on something and that works. That assumes that Kim is going into this seriously, and I've read and heard a lot of things that believe he is. And it's also important to know whether we're going into it with something other than soundbite potential and keeping the president on the front page.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to the difficult things, and we have a long history of this with North Korea, and it hasn't generally worked. It certainly is worth a try. I mean, it can't hurt. It's a festering problem that should have been dealt with a long time ago. You know, I mean, I've been doing lectures, not on this specifically, but when asked questions about it for at least 10 years, I've said one of the key things, I think on this show I've said this, not recently, that a key thing to this is a peace treaty. As long as the Korean War is going on,
right?
You're never going to get out from under it. Now, then the question is, okay, what's the price of ending the war? And when North Korea had not still had not developed a functioning nuclear capability, it might have been easier for us to do that. But, you know, Trump's not the only American president who doesn't like to show weakness. And American Congresses and American people don't like that either. So we tend to have to come away with talks saying, you know, we won and, mm-hmm. and we've shown strength. And then lots of times things don't pan out the way we thought. And that's been the case with North Korea, where there hasn't been a president who's come up with the idea, which Trump has or Trump's people have, of putting out one of the things we would do in this arrangement is agree to end the Korean War.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, with that and with everything, the difficulties in the details.
Yeah.
What does that mean? And what about our relationship with South Korea?
Sure, absolutely.
And what about our nuclear umbrella that covers South Korea? And what about the Japanese? And on the North Korean side, I was reading today in the New York Times, there was articles pointing out that the Chinese are very worried about this because
what's their worry?
Well, the Chinese don't want North Korea being unified under a Western-oriented government that's an ally of the United States.
You don't look for unification, do you?
Well, people talk about that being the goal, and that's one of the stated goals, but it's not a goal that anybody's ever agreed upon what terms unification would occur under.
Right, right.
I mean, the speculation has always been...
The two governments are so totally different in their structure.
Right. Speculation has always been that the Kim family would like to unify North Korea under its aegis. And that's
the whole peninsula under its
right.
aegis. Yeah.
And that's something the Chinese would like, as opposed to it being unified under a government that's our ally. The Chinese, I don't think, want an American ally on its eastern border.
Yeah. Well, is this whole situation that we are in today partly generated by the fact that the North Koreans and the South Koreans kind of became friends during the Olympic world?
Well, yes, that's an interesting aspect. I mean, there have been feelers in the past.
I hope you folks, by the way, are listening to this show and not watching the news and waiting for some news out of Singapore, because this conversation is much more important. So go ahead.
And there's nothing coming out of Singapore, I don't think, for a couple of hours. But we've been through this before. I mean, there have been efforts between the South and North Koreans to legitimize or to normalize the relationship, and the South Koreans have given food and they've opened up trading centers on the border, and the South Koreans have stopped broadcasting things.
Yeah.
So they've done this, but it's always fallen apart.
Yeah.
Generally, because in the view you get here, because the North Koreans have reneged in one way or another what they're supposed to do.
Why is the economy of North Korea so shambles, and why are people so hungry? I mean, it's the same world as South Korea, which has been thriving. What is it with North Korea that has kept the population in such a shabby environment?
What was it with China until the 70s when they transformed the economy that kept China so poor? What was it about the Soviet Union that kept those people so poor? And it's because of the system of government.
The Soviet Union is still kind of bad shape economically.
Russia. Soviet Union's gone.
Russia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a central command economy has never anywhere shown success. It hasn't in Cuba. It's not showing success in Venezuela.
It looks like it's not happening in Venezuela.
And that's what North Korea has, compounded by the fact that it's a family dynasty.
Yeah.
As was Cuba. In a way. And Cuba is changing and will change because the path they've been on for 60 years or 70 years is not sustainable. So that's what happens to North Korea, is that the Chinese keep them afloat but don't make them any better off than China has to. And under a command economy where everything is produced by the state for the state and they dole things out, people don't work the same way they do when they're working for their own benefit. And Kim Jong-un has actually eased up on some of those things, and people now are enabled to have private plots and engage in some kinds of trade. But those are meager steps, and mm-hmm. I think the country is still desperately poor, faces famine on a regular basis.
How did this
basis.
Family dynasty begin?
Because, well, back, I forget, I don't know where the senior Kim was, but he was obviously an acolyte of either Mao or the Russians.
Uh-huh.
Like Ho Chi Minh and people in Vietnam who had studied in Russia and were recruited by international communism, and I assume that's what his family was. And so he was the de facto ruler of the northern part of the Korean Peninsula, accepted by the Chinese as such.
Well, the there was at one time one Korea, wasn't there?
Well, yes. Back in the day, there had been a number of these things. I mean, there were unified Koreas.
It was a country called Chosin. Wasn't there a previous name to that area?
I think that's right.
Yeah.
So, but again, that probably ended. Certainly, well, I'm not an expert on this, but I assume it ended. It certainly ended with the Second World War when Korea as a whole was taken over by Japan.
Oh, that's right. Japan was, yeah, that's right. That's where the love got lost between the two countries, right?
Right. And at the end of the Korean War, again, I'm not familiar with the details of how we ended up in the southern part of the Korean Peninsula and not the northern part, but there apparently was a ceasefire that was agreed upon at a certain degree of latitude.
Yeah.
And then Kim decided to make a play to conquer all of Korea. And he invaded the South and uh-huh. took us by surprise and almost kicked our forces out of Korea.
Yeah.
And then there was the famous Incheon landing behind the lines.
Which was...
And once that happened, we rolled up all the way to the border.
Yeah.
And then that's when MacArthur was saying, well, you know, we ought to take care of those Chinese while we're at it. And
right.
Truman wouldn't do that and fired MacArthur. But by that time, we had gotten up to the Yalu River,
yeah,
and the Chinese weren't going to tolerate that, and so the Chinese entered the war and forced us back to the armistice line that had been agreed upon in the first place.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that was a terrible situation. I mean, that we handled that war from the military point of view pretty badly, from what I understand.
Well, you know, we have this tendency. We had essentially at the end of World War II demilitarized. I mean,
yeah.
we brought most of our boys home,
yeah,
and put them back in civilian clothing. So
that's right.
What we had left in Korea and other places were rump forces. And then, you know, we really weren't prepared, and we reacted finally quite well, but in the end, we weren't willing to go to war against China.
No, that's
for the
right.
sake of the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, these international events are certainly always stewing. I mean, we're stewing with our neighbors right now about issues, trade issues. We're stewing with Iran, which it seems to me there may be some discussion in Iran to clarify that and get it back on track.
Is that right?
Yeah. I even heard that Trump's willing to have some discussions.
Well, he's willing to have discussions on his terms, which aren't acceptable to anybody else. And so far, he's still hoping that somehow the Europeans will agree to undoing the current arrangement or renegotiating the arrangement that we got out of with Iran, at the very least by extending the terms of the moratorium on them developing nuclear weapons. The Europeans haven't had much, Europeans haven't shown much enthusiasm for that. They haven't had much success. There's no indication the Chinese and the Russians will go along with that, and there's no indication that the Iranians are willing to renegotiate it.
Well, that's not a treaty, I guess, is it?
No, it was
treaties have to go through Congress.
It was an executive agreement.
Yeah,
we have done very few treaties. We do very few treaties because It's very difficult to get two-thirds of the Senate to approve it. And so all administrations have resorted to trade agreements. And the problem with trade agreements is a trade agreement, in order to go into effect, has to be implemented by legislation.
Right.
So they finally, I'm not sure whether this is probably before Clinton, probably under Reagan, worked out an arrangement for trade deals.
Okay.
Because it was impossible to negotiate trade arrangements.
Well, now, is that what you call the Iranian deal, a trade?
No, but it would be in the same boat where I'm getting. So you had to have an arrangement with Congress.
Yeah.
That they would accept the thing or not. Implementing legislation to carry it out as it stood and not be able to negotiate it. I mean, what happens with treaty negotiations the way we do it, the executive negotiates the treaty, then it comes back and has to go to the Senate, and the Senate says, well, wait a minute, we don't like this, that, and the other thing.
Yeah.
Well,
then you have to go back and start over again.
And then the other country says, wait a minute, you know, we've signed on to this. So for a lot of things, they reached agreement that what you do is you have congressional people in the delegation, and they sign an agreement that says they pass legislation that says these kind of things will be approved as presented to the Congress with no amendments allowed.
In other words, the Congress is kind of involved with the terms as originally developed.
And a bit of the problem with this is, and this was the case with the Iran thing, because the Iran deal required us to take certain action with regard to the sanctions.
Yeah, right.
And Congress refused to do a number of them. This is now Obama negotiating an agreement that the Republicans hated. And so when it comes time to implementing, the Republican Congress wouldn't do all the things it was supposed to do, freeing up money. You'll remember
We gave some money back to them.
We gave a very small amount, smaller. The people in Congress are saying there's going to be $75 or $100 billion Iran's going to have tomorrow to invest in arms for Syria. Well, that wasn't true.
Uh-huh.
We've not eased licenses for Boeing and others to export. We've not granted Ex-Im Bank loans for Boeing and other companies to... So, you know, the Iranians have taken the position that we're the ones who have been in violation of this. We take the position that, this is a story we've
What's
heard.
The deal with Iran and Syria? I mean, Iran seems to be Syria's best friend.
Yes. Well, Iran does not like fundamentalist Sunni governments.
Oh, okay.
And
go back to that again. You always throw these Sunnis in every time we have a conversation.
And they much prefer a government that protects Muslim minority groups such as Shia. We won't go into definitions of those two.
No.
And they've done this not only in Syria, but that's why they... supported the Iraqi government that's in power now, and that's why they're active in Yemen. If you listen to the Saudis, it's because the Iranians want hegemony over the Middle East, and I don't think that's the case at all, but I think they don't mind at all sticking a needle in our eye.
You get your game board out in front of you. You got Yemen, you got Saudis, you got Iran, you got Syria, you got Iraq on the side and Lebanon on another side.
Right.
Israel totally separated.
No, because Israel's playing this game for their own purposes as well. So now you find that there's great agreement between the Israelis and the Saudis are the best of friends because they don't like the Iranians. I mean, back in the
day. Is that right? Are they dealing with each other? Friendly?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Apparently in all sorts of ways. They're certainly cooperating in Syria. I'm not sure the Israelis are involved in Yemen, but they're certainly cooperating in Syria. And this was the same thing, if you remember back to the 1980s when Iran and Iraq went to war.
Yeah, right. Was that in the 80s?
The 80s. Uh-huh. Essentially, Iran-Contra came about because we and the Israelis both were supporting, I'm going to get this wrong, I think we were supporting Iran against Iraq.
Well, Iraq, of course, was run by Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein, that's right.
And we consider him evil.
We consider him evil now, but I think we may have supported Saddam Hussein in that war. And the we supported Saddam Hussein. The Israelis supported Iran because the enemy of their enemy was their friend, and Iran at that time was further away from Israel and didn't have, it wasn't developing nuclear capability.
Right, yeah.
And Iraq was much closer to them. And so you had this thing where...
And Netanyahu wasn't sitting around making nasty remarks
about Iran. That's right. But arms were being... The whole Iran-Contra thing came up because U.S. arms were going to Iran via Israel in contravention of the Iran-Contra legislation that said we couldn't supply any arms to either of those.
Wow. You're listening to a confusing conversation. I mean, the world is so up and down. I mean, but you're going to listen to this conversation anyway because you're listening to WCOM. This is your voice in the community, and your voice in the community is full of information from Ambassador Michael Cotter about the Middle East and about Korea, and we haven't touched Central America yet. We may not get to them today. You never know.
No. You know, there's lots been written on all of these topics. And you can sit and go to Wikipedia, and Wikipedia the Iran-Iraq War. You can go to Wikipedia and look for U.S.-Iran relations now and earlier. There's all sorts of sources out there. So people, you know, who are listening and find this sort of confusing and would like more, I encourage you to go to Wikipedia if there are questions here that have come up that you don't quite understand. If you don't understand what's the difference between Sunni and Shia. You know,
I like to study that. I've had three classes recently at church I go to, Sunday morning classes, presented by the imam, interim imam at Duke University.
Oh, uh-huh.
And on the Muslim world, on Islam. And it was, you know, we didn't get into politics, but we got into their beliefs and so forth.
Right.
And, you know, I can see why when you're dealing with that particular group of thinkers, their religion is so structured that there's no variety. You can't maybe go halfway toward one thing or another. You do what the Quran says, and it's pretty much that way.
Well, not exactly. They're you could say the same thing about Christianity. You do what the Bible says. But every Baptist minister in the world will interpret that document differently, and Catholics interpret it. I mean, so the Bible is what those interpreting it say comes from the Bible, and the Quran has the same problem because in addition to the Quran itself, which is fairly cryptic in many ways. You've right. got hadith, which are the sayings of the prophet and other things,
right,
which
right.
not things that supposedly are divinely inspired, but his sayings. And then you've got sayings by earlier Muslim leaders about how they thought about the Quran. I mean, it's the same thing as the Old Testament. You know, you've got the Talmud and all of the
That's
millennia
true. That,
of Jewish
you know, I would
writers.
Consider that Christianity.
No, but that's the Judaism has that issue, and Christianity right. has that issue. I mean, the Reformation was because Martin Luther and other people believed that the Catholic Church was misinterpreting what the Bible
right.
said,
right.
and believed that everybody ought to read the Bible in their own language. But of course, once you invite people to do that, everybody who reads the Bible believes that they understand what the Bible says,
what and they what want is, to believe, right?
What yeah. is unerring truth. So, all of all religions, I think, suffer from that. I mean, there are different strains of Buddhism that believe different things. Hinduism,
that's right. That's true.
Hinduism has different interpretations of things, and then you keep having people who pop up, you know, claiming to be inspired by God and invent new religions or try to invent new religions. And generally, they're either like the fellow down in Waco, Texas, who is, you know, wiped out as a deviant.
Right.
Or
right.
if he's successful, you know, or the Mormons. You know,
sure,
got as far as Illinois right. and yeah. were almost wiped out in Illinois and had to go to a place where there was no federal, really federal government control so that they could develop their own theology.
Yeah, well, that's true. I guess you're interpreting all of these religions have their own variations, don't they?
Right.
And but I was impressed with this imam who spoke with finality about the issues that he was talking about and quoting the Quran and
sure.
very, very, very specific. So my point that I was trying to make that that religion seems to be from what in just reading the language seems to be a tighter approach than maybe Christianity, which maybe have some variations.
I don't think so. My guess is if your church, I don't know whether you're Episcopalian or Methodist or Baptist, but my guess is if you're Episcopalian and you bring in the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, you're going to get a whole different story
quite
about
true.
What the Bible says than you're going to get from the Episcopal Church.
Right.
A whole different story. And he's not going to say, well, there are various ways of looking at this. He's going to say, this is what the Bible says.
Right. Well,
and that's no different from this imam coming in and saying, this is what the Quran says, and this is what the correct beliefs of Islam are. And if you listen to these other guys, they're heretics.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, we're not discussing religion. We're discussing international affairs with our own expert, Michael Cotter. I guess we covered Iran. We certainly covered Korea. How do you feel about the American embassy moving from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem? Is that a good idea? Is that okay? Or is it not worth talking about?
Well, I wouldn't think it's a good idea. On the other hand, it has always been a function of the Palestinian situation and negotiating between Israel and the Palestinians about the future of the Palestinian people. And since that whole thing seems to be in shambles and seems right now not to be of much interest to anybody other than the Palestinians, since you now have the Saudis and the Israelis finding greater common cause in uh-huh. dealing with uh-huh. Iran than they do in arguing over the right of the Palestinians. So as a result, the Palestinians are sort of left in limbo for the time being. And the embassy movement is only part of that. I mean, the idea probably has always been, I think, that Jerusalem would end up being some kind of either a neutral city enjoyed by all three of the major Abrahamic religions.
Right.
Or, and this may still be the case, is that East Jerusalem would be the capital of Israel and West Jerusalem would be the capital of a Palestinian state in a two-state solution. And if it had been done that way, there wouldn't be a problem. The way it was done simply said we're moving our embassy to Jerusalem. And then other people pointed out that, yes, but it will be, in fact, in East Jerusalem, so that doesn't preclude another option. But those voices sort of got lost in the uproar. So is it a game ender? No, not really. Did it help anything? Certainly didn't. But on the other hand, with Trump's Israel-Palestinian policy in the hands of Jared Kushner, who doesn't seem to be doing much of anything. I don't think in the long run it makes that big a difference.
Okay. Well, but the Israelis and the Palestinians continue to shoot each other. There's got to be a direct answer to this issue that's easily visible, but nobody wants to follow it up.
In theory, but these are very complicated things. And over the 70 years, whatever it was, since the creation of the State of Israel,
right.
Things have gotten terribly caught up in broader international political issues. And, you know, the agreement or the idea on our side has always been, and the Israelis have accepted this more or less, Netanyahu less, that there should be a separate state for the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
Where that would be, how you would have a state for the Palestinians that would be contiguous and be functional. What you do with the Gaza Strip is another issue. I think some Israelis, their solution, they'd like to see Jordan take it over and have a border with Jordan. I mean, so there are
numbers. And have no Palestine.
Right. I mean, their view sort of is that Jordanians are all the same people as Palestinians. Now,
yeah.
I don't want to get you getting a lot of phone calls about this because because I'm not really – I am not speaking, you know, from any terribly great knowledge other than following it of the issue. But, I mean, the Middle East is very complicated. And
we in theory, say that again quietly. Complicated, boy, it is complicated.
In theory, you know, in theory, you would have had a state when the British got out that was a multinational state. That didn't happen, and so then you immediately
Whole thing started out wrong, didn't it?
The whole thing started out wrong.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is not easy, and there is nothing. There are a variety of solutions one could look at, but they always become caught up in larger.
Well, don't issues. What's the situation on the so-called West Bank? Is that an Israeli or neutral ground or Palestinian territory?
Israel controls the territory up to the West Bank of the Jordan River. And that's what the Palestinians call the occupied territories. I forget what the term the Israelis use for it is. But the problem the Palestinians have is that they are dysfunctional politically. So president,
that's true.
The president is 80 some years old. There hasn't been an election for like 10 years.
Really?
Wow. He has not been willing to give up power. There have been competing views between either more violent factions or more peaceful factions over where policy should go. As long as Hamas, which is a more radical group, controls Gaza and Fatah,
Is Gaza an ungoverned territory?
Right. It was conquered by Israel. The Israelis gave it up, but it sits there. The Egyptians don't like it. The Israelis don't like it, and it essentially is a giant prison camp.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Israeli view is that as long as Hamas, which avowedly insists upon the destruction of Israel, runs it, that Israel isn't about to come to grips with it.
And Gaza doesn't have its own military or police or anything.
It has its own police.
Police?
Under Hamas.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But it doesn't have any resources. It's completely dependent on outside help. I mean,
it's a tiny
space with a lot of people.
Yeah.
So, you know, what I have no idea what happens to Hamas in a settlement. Not to Hamas, I'm sorry. What happens to the Gaza Strip in a settlement?
Well, if you were back in the Foreign Service in the Department of State, where would you like to be and what would you like to be doing today?
I wouldn't be back in the Foreign Service if I were. It would depend on where I was in my career.
Well, I mean, put yourself back there. What would you like to be? What part of the function of the department would be appealing to you? I know you've had an ambassadorship, which is a big deal, and that ended when you retired.
One of the reasons I retired when I did was because after my embassy, I wasn't offered any positions that were positions that I was interested in taking.
Yeah,
and I had enough years to retire. And I wasn't interested in going back and doing things I had done before that I wouldn't find challenging. So I had expertise more in Latin America than I did in any other region. And I was a political military officer, so I'd done political military things. And so, you know, I could have, in theory, gone as a State Department representative at the National War College. I've done those kind of things, gotten involved. I worked mostly in bilateral military relationships, not in arms control, so I was not an arms control
person. What's your role as a military personnel in the State Department?
I was the director of an office in the – well, I did a couple of things. In Turkey, I was we had a separate political military section doing NATO affairs. I probably would have gotten more involved in NATO things. So I was in the State Department director of the Office of Bilateral Military Relationships. And so because foreign aid comes through the State
Department. When you were in Turkey or were you in Washington?
That was when I was in Washington.
Okay.
In the State Department.
Okay.
And I did that before I went to Chile and then Turkmenistan. So
when you're doing that, who are you relating to?
Well, doing that within the State Department, you're relating to the development of the foreign military assistance programs and the funding of those programs and how they get spent.
So you're dealing with the Pentagon, kind of?
You deal with the Pentagon quite a bit. I was there when the Gulf War broke out, so a lot of our relationship was helping through embassies sort out transit approval for aircraft and. And the State Department was negotiating payment for, Gulf War didn't cost us anything. We got various allies to pay for it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the Koreans and the Japanese and a number of others put a lot of money into it because they weren't willing to send troops to the coalition. So, so we said, well, you know, we've got this big coalition that you guys are members of. How about paying for it? So the Gulf War cost us nothing.
Oh, wow.
Unlike the Iraq War.
Yeah.
But what would have been interesting probably going to the – so all of the different – the National War College, the Army War College, Navy postgraduate school, all have – they're led by a general of, or flag officer of whatever service.
Uh-huh.
And all of them have a vice president from the State Department. Most of them have.
Okay.
And they also have faculty members from the State Department. Uh-huh. So you find a lot of political, military, and other people who will go to those assignments.
These are jobs that we don't know anything about, and I assume from the way you're describing them, they're really essential in the function of our government, department to department, relating from state to defense and otherwise, and
right.
Agriculture and...
Well, what they are specifically is a box that military officers have to check to move up in their career. So,
yeah. Okay.
So if you're a major and want to be a colonel, if not higher, you're going to have to go to the Army War College, or even better, go to the National. I think National War College would probably be lieutenant colonels.
Are there two different war colleges?
Yeah, there's Army War College, Navy War College,
really?
Air Force War College,
oh,
and
really?
The National Defense University, which is the sort of umbrella organization. And so these are all things that military officers need to check that box.
Who are the faculty for these or colleges? Military people? Or?
Military people, State Department people.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure.
Or academics,
CIA
plain,
people.
Plain ordinary PhDs.
Academics.
Uh-huh.
And so a lot of civilians go to them too. So the State Department has officers in each one of those. CIA has officers in each one of those. I suspect Treasury Department probably sends people to the various war colleges.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more difficult. It has always been a little more difficult for the State Department because while this is seen as a box a military officer needs to check to move ahead in his career, for a State Department officer, uh-huh. It's looked at as you're off here at the side doing something. We don't understand what it's like. So when we're evaluating you against all of your peers for your next promotion,
yeah.
it looks a little
it's
odd.
It's a tricky world down there in the swamp.
The I'll swamp is very tricky.
I want government. You folks to pay attention to this now. Channel 18 in Durham, Channel 8 in Chapel Hill, has been showing at 9 o'clock Tuesday night an interview with Ambassador Cotter. And I don't know how many weeks this will be on. It's been on for at least 2 weeks, and it should be on again tomorrow night at 9 o'clock. Channel 18 in Durham and Channel 8 in Chapel Hill. So you'll see the man that you're listening to, and you'll see the same interviewer, so you can decide whether you want to watch it or not. And there's no commercials, so it's commercial-free, and who knows, maybe we'll all reach stardom.
Well, we can only hope.
Anyway, I want to thank a few people. I want to say, first thing, by the way, that this is your voice in the community, WCOM. We are supported by individuals and businesses in the community. You can easily send us money by going to our website, WCOMFM.org, and make a safe and secure donation. Or you can stop by here. We are at 300 East Main Street in Carrboro, just in from Chapel Hill, and drop a check in an envelope under the door, and you will receive credit. And you might even get your name mentioned here on the show. And every donation that comes to WCOM is tax deductible. I would also like to thank Ambassador Cotter himself for being an underwriter of this show, and we appreciate your support. I really do. I'd also like to thank the Triangle Association of Health Underwriters. These are folks who will help you work your way through the complexities of finding health insurance for yourself and your family. And I would also like to thank Tim Hux. Tim was on the show last week talking sports, and it was a lot of fun. We'll do that again sometime. And Tim is the owner of a financial service company called Rising Tide. He will invest, help you invest your money and hopefully rise with the tide. And we have a recent underwriter, MidCap Advisors, and also a financial services company from New York City that specializes in mergers and acquisitions. And these are folks that help underwrite this show. And other shows are underwritten by many businesses and many individuals, both in Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and elsewhere. So what did we accomplish today, Ambassador? Did we solve any problems that are going to make the headlines of the Washington Post?
No, I don't think so. You know, and what we never did get to was Trump and the Atlantic Alliance.
Okay. Well, we have a couple of minutes.
Well, that's not going well.
Okay.
in a word.
Why do we tell the Prime Minister of Canada that he's weak?
I don't know. Why do we call him all sorts of names and then are surprised when he takes umbrage at it? Why are we apparently undoing the alliance?
Which has been a great alliance.
Which has been, you know, the base rock of our foreign policy since the end of the Second World War. I have absolutely no idea. And I wish that there were some thought behind this, and I don't believe there is. I think it's personal pique, and it's really just an incredibly depressing thing. And I think, you know, the problem with this is, in a nutshell, is that the world is changing. And we've talked about this before, so I have a very strong feeling that the end of the Cold War means a whole range of things globally are changing. China yeah. is now here. Russia is changing.
Yeah.
Europe has problems. There's violence around the world. And it's very clear that this is changing.
Immigrants themselves are a big problem.
Right, exactly. And so somehow there has to be a new world that emerges from this, and a new world relationship that tries to deal with these things. But mm-hmm. we aren't going to do it by ourselves. And if we withdraw from the world and sort of, you know, pull up our borders, you can't do that if you're the single largest economy in the world and the motor that runs things. So it's very hard for me to see how we can take this kind of a position and not have very bad things occur and not find ourselves insulated from those. And I think, you know, a lot of people who support President Trump, I think, are going to be disappointed when they see the results. Unfortunately, we're also paying the price that I think our education system has failed over the past 40 years. You know, every once in a while you see statistics about very basic things, you know, who was president during the Civil War, you know, who was the president before Bill Clinton, and mm-hmm. two-thirds of high school students have no idea who it was. And so it's not surprising that most Americans who have never traveled don't particularly see what the European Union does for us.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so when Trump comes up and says they're all taking advantage of us and repeats that mantra time and time again, people believe it.
Sure. Yeah.
In spite of the fact that it's not true. And so that emboldens him to take positions that in the end ultimately are going to hurt people. I mean, if car prices go up 15%, it's going to hurt people. We sort of need to buy a new car, and I've been putting it off. But I think, you know, this isn't going to be good. If you're a construction company thinking of building a building out of steel, this is not good for you.
Yeah. Well, okay, we'll talk about that next time.
Okay.
And we got to sign off, folks, and thank you again, Ambassador Carter. Great to have you here and to talk with you and learn from your experience and just your everyday knowledge. And I forgot to tell people he has he's the publisher of a journal called
American Diplomacy.
And it is published right here in Chapel Hill. And it's a great, it's not for everybody to read, but I have seen it several times and it's terrifically written with a lot of good articles about the things we're talking about today.
Thanks very much, Bill, and thanks for having me. I always enjoy being on the show.
Come again.